Call Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is March the 25th. It's a couple of minutes after 9 a.m. We're in Senate Finance Room in the state capital, Juneau, Alaska. Present, we have Chairman Olson, Chairman Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Senator Hoffman. We have two items on the agenda today. The first item is the CS for House Bill 59, an act making supplemental appropriations, making appropriations to capitalize funds and providing for an effective date. And the second portion of the meeting's agenda today is a presentation from the Alaska Broadband Office. So the first item, Mr. Pete Eklund, can you come forward? And can we have a motion, Chairman Stedman?
Like a motion?
To adopt the CS.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 59 Finance Version N as our working document.
And I'll object for explanation. Mr. Eklund, can you go over the changes?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Pete Eklund, staff to Senator Hoffman and the Senate Finance Committee. What you have in front of you is, I guess, an omnibus supplemental bill. It includes capital and operating items, Mr. Chairman. And I would just bring the committee's attention just to start to the – you have three documents labeled A, B, and C in your packet. Letter A is a short fiscal summary produced by Legislative Finance Division. I would just point out, Mr. Chairman, that about three-quarters of the way down that page, you'd see there's a post-transfer surplus deficit of $81.1 million in FY25. So, Mr. Chairman, that before any new appropriations are made in FY25 in this bill for these supplementals, there's already an $81.1 million deficit because of reduced when we left last session, we had a small surplus. And after the fall and spring revenue forecast, we have a deficit before we have any new spending, Mr. Chairman. And you'll see further down on that row in FY25, there's in this supplemental bill, there's a $111.4 million of unrestricted general funds proposed to be spent, Mr. Chairman. Further, in designated general funds, there's a negative $24 million of designated general funds, and that's mostly related to cleaning up how the University of Alaska categorizes funds, and it's by reducing university receipts. That's where that negative $24 million in designated general funds comes from. In federal funds, the bill in front of you has $288.1 million of appropriations. Most of that is related to Medicaid, about $215 million. And on the capital side, it's federal grants to plug orphaned wells. In other funds, Mr. Chairman, that's $163.5 million. And again, most of that is related to the university and them cleaning up how they budget. So there's increases in interagency receipts and statutory designated program receipts. Then finally, Mr. Chairman, when you add up all those categories, in total funds, the bill in front of you is roughly $539 million. Mr. Chairman, the committee substitute incorporates all the governor's supplemental items as requested, including the items in SB 59, the fast track supplemental. Excuse me, SB 84, the regular supplemental, and the unrestricted general fund item in SB 56, the operating budget, with a few exceptions that I'm going to outline here, Mr. Chairman. In the numbers section, the committee substitute changes the Alaska Vocational Technical Center item for electrician and plumbers classes. The governor's request was $888.6 million or 1,000 of UGF, unrestricted general funds. The bill in front of you has $660,000 of step funds for that purpose. The bill in front of you does not include a $1.6 million increment for VPSO positions, which were created but did not have legislative approval last session. In the capitals number section, there was a fund source change in the Alaska Marine Highway System. There was a request for $6.5 million for maintenance and overhaul to be used from the Alaska Marine Highway System Fund. That was switched to unrestricted general funds as we're trying to avoid a shortfall in the Alaska Marine Highway System Fund category in the future, in FY26. In the language section, Mr. Chairman, the governor's request was $10.1 million for fire suppression. This bill increases that request by $3 million because of the early start of the fire season. Also, there was a $10 million request using two reappropriations from FY21 that Legislative Legal Services told us were not a valid request, and so we've substituted unrestricted general funds for that purpose, and that's related to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. There was a penalty that needs to be paid there and required investment. Additionally, Mr. Chairman, there was in total in this bill, there's $29 million for the Disaster Relief Fund. The administration had requested of that $29 million, $3 million of a reappropriation, and that $3 million reappropriation request was changed to unrestricted general funds. And in the Department of Corrections, there is supervisory standby pay increment requests, and this CS breaks those requests into three appropriations to match the appropriation structure in the FY26 budget for the same purpose. The only other changes in the bill were technical. So besides the $3 million additional for fire suppression, this committee substitute does not add any items beyond the governor's request. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, the CBR language in this bill works basically by it would cover the $81 million or so deficit before any new appropriations. When you add in the new appropriations of $111.4 million, Mr. Chairman, we would add, we call it headroom, of approximately $7.5 million for any additional supplemental requests that might come between now and the end of session that we're unaware of yet. So when you add all that up, there's an approximate $200 million CBR draw requested in this bill, Mr. Chairman. And the way the language works is if the revenue is lower than projected, there would be a higher CBR draw just to cover that deficit. And if revenue is higher than projected, there would be a lower CBR draw because of that. Mr. Chairman, those are my comments on the bill.
Thank you for that explanation. Mr. Eklund, do any finance members have questions on the presentation for CS for Senate Bill 59? Seeing none, I will remove my objections. Is there any further objection to adopting the CS as our working document? Seeing none, it is adopted, and we will set this bill aside for further deliberation. We'll take a brief at ease. call the Finance Committee back to order to address the second item on our agenda today, which is an update from the Alaska Broadband Office. We invite Mr. Tom Loescher to the table. Please identify yourself and proceed to their presentation.
Thank you, and I appreciate you having me here today. My name is Thomas Lochner. I'm the director of the Alaska Broadband Office under Commissioner Sandy, under it within the Division of Community, Commerce, Community, and Regional and Economic Development. Okay. I'm here to provide an update on what's been happening with the two programs that the Alaska Broadband Office is managing. The first is the Alaska Grant Program, Broadband Grant Program, which is an extension of the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program that was under the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, or IIJA. And then the second one is the Digital Equity Act, also under IIJA, that the Broadband Office is managing. I have up before you the mission statement of the Broadband Office, and it makes sure it focuses not just on building stuff, but making sure that Alaskans get what they need with regard to broadband. When I was here last time, the staff only had four folks. We've grown a little bit as a function of need with requirements of the grant programs. We've added a project coordinator, which we hope to fill within the next couple weeks, and we've added the administrations manager, Naomi Johnson, to make sure that all of the budgeting that we have to do when we report up to the federal government on our programs is in alignment with state requirements and the federal requirements. If folks have any questions during, please feel free to interrupt. Starting with the Alaska Broadband Grant Program, the first thing we did, and you'll for the folks who were here last year, you'll recollect this slide. We developed partnerships within the state of Alaska and the different departments to make sure that we took advantage of having the best utilization of the labor resources available without having to then augment the broadband office itself. One I'd like to call out, two of them I'd like to call out specifically, is both within the Division of Community and Regional Affairs. The mapping, analytics, and data resources folks were critical in our mapping project to get all of the broadband serviceable locations. Those are the houses and small businesses that are eligible if they do not meet a certain bandwidth requirement. And they were absolutely critical in making sure that that data was as good as possible when filing with the NTIA. The second is the grant administration, and those folks have actually used their experience in grant administration with the block grants and several other grants to incorporate the Alaska Broadband Grant into it, as well as the Digital Empowerment Grant Program into their division. That way, again, the Alaska Broadband Office didn't have to go try and find a one-off program to put in. Just a refresher, the Alaska allocation for the BEAD, or Broadband Equity Access and Deployment funding, is just over $1 billion. We anticipate that we will be distributing two infrastructure projects just over $990 million.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. Just curious on your organizational chart, Mr. Lochner, you have a project coordinator, and then on the state partners, you have Department of Public Transportation and Public Facilities with a project coordination. Could you just expound a little bit on the division of tasks between those two seemingly duplicate items?
Through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Kaufman. Yes, and it's the Venn diagram of the overall project and making sure that the project management on the overall funding and infrastructure builds, including some potential satellite builds, versus the individual department's needs for project management within that department. Does that help?
Senator Kaufman?
I think I've got it. Thank you.
Okay.
Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that current slide, slide number 6, of that billion, how much, if any, has been sequestered or slowed down or frozen from the federal perspective?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Stedman. None of it.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Thank you. Wanted to go over the major accomplishments since I spoke to this group. I know there's some new members, so it'll be new. Last year, we did submit our proposal in December. We got our proposal approved October 10th, and you'll note that that's a significant amount of time. I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about that, in that there were two challenges primarily that we were faced with, which protracted the approval of our program. One was a footnote that was in the BEAD Notice of Funding Opportunity, or NOFO. It was footnote 70, which modified subsection 15 to the final proposal. And subsection 15 said that on tribal lands, the owner has the authority over the land. Footnote 70 then modified that and said, in order to have a project assigned, you have to have 51% of the tribes in the region approve the project within an area. And Tribal Liaison Kukesh immediately pointed out that violated the ANCSA agreement. That gives, and we had it vetted through the Department of Law, it indeed violated the ANCSA agreement in that it gave ownership and authority over the land to non-landowners. And so the NTIA, the way they put it to the ABO is, look, that's great that the village corporations own the surface rights and that the regional corporations own the subsurface rights, but the tribe is the trusted relationship with the federal government, so they have to be involved in any project on those lands. And so that took a long time to resolve with them. We did get a resolution in that effectively we went back to subsection 15, which basically said the landowner gets the authority over what permits or easements are granted on the land, as it should be. But as a compromise, each applicant has to touch base and show that they made a very strong and good faith effort to contact all the tribes within the region to let them know what's going on. There was a tribal broadband connectivity award where there was a consortium, and the consortium head, who then got the award, then totally stopped talking to folks. And so we wanted to make sure that at least there was communications with folks. The second holdup was there was some concern that one of the other non-NTIA or National Telecommunications and Information Administration programs through the federal government was going to fail, and it covered pretty much one of the entire regions of Alaska. And if that had failed and the Alaska Broadband Office had submitted our mapping and that failed after we submitted our mapping, there was no way to bring those broadband serviceable locations or homes and small businesses back into the program. So we purposefully delayed filing the mapping while we sorted out with the other agency whether that program was going to go forward or not. Ultimately, that program, they did get it resolved, and it is moving forward. And so as a consequence, we then were able to file our final mapping program. But those were the two major delays that caused us to push back. We did launch after the October 10th. We held a 30-day public review, and then we had the administration review our work. Launched our grant on December 16th of last year, and we anticipated closing the grant on April 14th. But you'll see in my timeline slide, there's a 30-day pause, for lack of a better word, that we put on to try and accommodate for what we think might be coming out of Washington. Wanted to go into the grant program because this is very exciting for me. The way the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment NOFO was set up, it was just a lot of ideas all over the place, and the broadband office worked very hard because there are the opportunity for new applicants to apply, how to organize the grant program so that it was intuitive. And so we sat around and said, what's the first thing you need when you're starting a business? A business license. That's number one. What's the second thing you need? People. That's number two. What's the third thing you need? You need to know where the money's coming from. That's number four, or number three. Number four is other grant programs. That is a reporting function of the NTIA. Number five is, what are we going to build? So that then becomes the technical capacity and the technical requirements of the network itself. Number six, moving down, just kind of the intuitive way that at least I think about starting a business, will this be sustainable? So, okay, is there a sustainability model that we need to look at to make sure that this lasts for 10 years? We had the situation in one of the villages where they got an allocation of FCC licensed bandwidth and the 2.5 gigahertz spectrum range. They set up a Wi-Fi for the entire village. They had backhaul through a LEO provider. And as soon as the LEO provider was in the beta of their system, as soon as they went to production and sent their first bill, they turned it all off and bought Starlink. Because the cost of that LEO provider's capacity overwhelmed the revenue that was coming out of that village.
Can you explain what a LEO provider is?
I apologize. Thank you, Chair. Low Earth Orbit satellite provider. There are currently four. There's Starlink. Kuiper has two. They through Amazon, they plan on launching several more this year and next year to cover most of the United States. They're looking at Alaska in 2028. There's OneWeb, and then there's a Canadian company called Telsat, I believe. And so the difference is low Earth orbit is only about 3,000 miles up, mid orbit is about 15,000, and geosynchronous orbit is about 23,000 miles up.
Thank you.
So moving down, 7 and 8 is simply, will we comply with the laws? 9 is, what are the risks? 9 and 10 are, what are the risks to the network? 11 is, what is the risk to the environment? And so as you can see, we've tried very hard. Number 12 is what I just talked about, making sure that you're in communication with the folks who are impacted. 13 and 14 will most likely go away with the impact of the what's happening in Washington, because what they're saying is if you have a fixed rate low cost option and a fixed rate middle class opportunity number, that effectively is rate regulation. And so without anybody to follow through on that regulation, they're saying that needs to go. And then 15 is we did something unusual that's different than any other state, is we published the contract we're planning on using. We vetted it through Department of Law, and we published it, and we invited people to say, hey, if you've got problems with this contract on the front end, please let us know, because this is going to be the contract that we're going to use. The difference there is we've heard other states, they make an award, and then they spend 6 months negotiating the contract. Because there's a 300, I forgot to mention, I apologize, when we got awarded on October 10th, it started a 365-day shot clock to completely finish our grant program and recommended awards. So we are sensitive to that, making sure we don't move past that 365-day shot clock. And so we wanted to make sure that we streamlined everything we could up front. On the scoring side, the scoring was also dictated by the NTIA's Broadband Equity Access and Deployment NOFO. And so we worked with the NTIA to come up with what we thought was a reasonable scoring. Some of the scoring also will change. The affordability program will change because it also has numbers associated with it that might be construed as rate regulation. The one thing we did do is we offered 10 points for folks to use the Office of Program Management and Permitting. Again, that's an effort to, through the DNR, who has the relationships on permitting with the other agencies and with the federal agencies, to make sure that we streamline permitting as much as possible. When I was at Arctic Slope Telephone, we had a project to go to Akasuk, and it was 3.5 years worth of permitting for 7 months worth of work. And so the permitting really is the old saying goes, long pole in the tent. Moving down to the timeline, I left in my estimate from last year. I estimated that we would start the program in August. That's that first bracket, and that we would be done by the end of February on our evaluations to then submit to the NTIA. As you can see, the green brackets is where we actually started, and we were anticipating ending on April 14th. But starting last Friday, we put up, again, for lack of a better word, pause to do a 30-day executive order impact review to try and understand what the impacts to the grant program are going to be coming out of the different executive orders and the change of leadership within Washington. We don't fully know that yet. We do know about the low-cost option and the middle-class affordability, but other than that, it's a moving target. Congressman Hudson, I believe, out of North Carolina, has submitted a bill, and so that gives us a little bit of visibility on what might be happening through the Congress. We don't know yet what Secretary Lutnick or Assistant Secretary Roth are going to do. That then anticipate mid-May close of the application period. Then we will take the 90 days necessary to review all the applications. We've contracted out or are in the process of contracting out National Environmental Protection Agency consultants as well as professional engineers to help us review the applications that are coming in. Once that 90 days and we've settled on what we think the appropriate mix of applicant potential awardees are, we'll have the administration review it and then submit it as our final proposal to the NTIA for their review. We anticipate 90 days for that because they'll come back with cures and questions, and that will be a back and forth. And so we're looking at a mid-December award. Merry Christmas to the applicants, and then a start early next year. Any questions on the Alaska Broadband Grant Program before I move to digital empowerment?
So do you have a map of what you anticipate the coverage to be for the broadband program? And can you describe for the committee and the audience many people already have Starlink or other programs. What can people of Alaska expect when the fiber comes in, comparing the two?
That is an excellent question to the chair. We do have a map. It's on the Alaska Broadband Office website as a resource, and it shows every single broadband serviceable location in its predetermined project area. And I'll explain that in a moment, by either unserved, which is cannot receive 25 megabits per second download, and that's streaming movies, and 3 megabits upload, which is posting my pictures to the internet, or underserved, which can't reach 100 megabits per second download and 20 megabits per second upload. So it shows every single broadband service location that we have been approved for on that map. It also shows where the community boundaries are so that we could look at what broadband serviceable locations or BSLs fall within a community and which ones we euphemistically call them Patsy's Cabins, because the very first one I looked at on the FCC map and the only one that's labeled is called Patsy's Cabin. I happened to meet her nephew at one of the events, and it's just north of Mountain Village. But it's off a slough off of the Yukon River. That will most likely, because that would be a $7 to $10 million build just to that single broadband serviceable location, that will most likely have to be some sort of satellite solution, whether it's Starlink or Kuiper. Starlink does keep their roles confidential, so we don't have a sense of which locations are already served by Starlink. The challenge with any low Earth orbit satellite provider is that it is like a giant cell site in the sky, right? If you're the only person on it, it's great. If you got 100 people on it, it starts shrinking its ability to service. Just before this meeting, I went to a site called satellitemap.space. It's hypnotizing because it shows all of the Starlink satellites in the constellation, and where there's a band around the Earth that covers the lower 48 brilliantly. It's, you know, almost can't see through it. There's only usually 5 to 7 Starlink satellites over Alaska at any given time. When I looked at it just before I came up here, it's interesting, the launch they did when they launched 3 rockets, the Dragon to go get the guys out of space, and then they launched other satellites, and then they launched a bunch of Starlink satellites. Those satellites are in a row right over Alaska, and as you watch it, you'll see them deploy into different areas. But generally, over Alaska, there's only 5 to 7 Starlink satellite at any given time. So if there's more and more adoption, they'll either have to put more birds up or the service will go down.
But what's the basic service difference between a Starlink and a fiber?
Thank you for the clarification question. Starlink, I think, maxes out when there's low density on the satellite, maxes out at about 230 megabits down and about 50 up. When it's higher, it can go down to just under 100 megabits down and 20 megabits up. With fiber, you can do, depending on how it's configured on the electronics, you can do 30 terabytes worth of data. So orders of magnitude. If we think that AI is going to come through as they're predicting, and we will need the data centers associated with AI, as well as machine-to-machine communications, smart fridges, that sort of thing, that they'll have the need for more and more bandwidth. And as a consequence, it's my opinion that that will ultimately overwhelm the capacity that Starlink has.
And one final question. Once this whole broadband is in place, where will Alaska be in connectivity in the United States?
That is a wonderful but very challenging question. Before they allocated the $1 billion to the state of Alaska, we sent a letter to the NTIA that said, we've done an analysis of what's required in Alaska. It's going to be about $2 billion. And so as a consequence, they went through and did their own evaluation and came to half of that. Fortunately, Alaska has been quite successful with the other programs, the Tribal Broadband Connectivity Round 2, the USDA's Reconnect and Community Connect programs, and that has offset. But we will still, again, in my opinion, but I need to make sure I work the numbers after I get the applications in, we will still have some areas that will be extraordinarily high cost, and as a consequence, we'll have no alternative but to service them with a low Earth orbit option. So I would say 96% of Alaska would be fibered out, and then the last 4% would still be that extremely high cost.
How does that compare to the lower 48 on average?
Thank you, Chair. I will get that information and get that to the committee. I don't have that off the top of my head.
Thank you. Please proceed.
The formerly known digital equity capacity grant program, there are three tranches associated with the former digital equity plan. There's the planning, there's the capacity grants, which will run through the state of Alaska and the state of Alaska will manage, and then there's the competitive grants, which folks submitted straight to the NTIA. You can see we've been awarded just under $600,000. We contracted to the Rasmussen Foundation to help do the research and write our digital equity plan. And then out of the $1.4 billion we were given in this first tranche, which represents 22, 23, and 24, just over $5.6 million. We anticipate that there will be a $1.8 million for 2025 and a $1.8 for 2026 that will come in, which will be the sum total of the awards for the digital empowerment. And what this is, it's great now that you build it. Now let's make sure that folks know how to use it, from turning it on, recognizing what the screen is, making sure there's antivirus loaded up, making sure that folks aren't susceptible to cybersecurity. And this will be just enough, I think, to kind of tap the surface. It in no way is comprehensive in all that needs to be done on digital empowerment, especially with cybersecurity and making sure that folks are safe. But it's the amount we've given, and we're making sure that with what we've been given, we can at least get a start on getting ahead of digital empowerment.
The question I have is, once this infrastructure is in place, how is it maintained? What is the funding required to ensure that the broadband services are going on a continued basis?
Thank you, Chair. That's a fantastic question, and that's why we put in criterion number 6, a sustainability model. And so applicants, when they go in and apply, they can plug in their information. It has every single community in Alaska and the number of broadband serviceable locations associated with each of those communities. And so they can put in their numbers, and it will come back and tell them whether the sustainability is black or in red brackets. We did that purposefully because we wanted to have folks come to the applications with eyes wide open. I just received a presentation from a company called Tribal Ready, and they put up a slide and said, well, you have to have at least 3,000 households or small businesses in order to make one of these programs work in a community. And so I immediately, unfortunately, interrupted their presentation, pulled down the census data for the households in every village, sorted it by size, and found that every single one, there's about 11, that's over 3,000 households, already has fiber. So the reason we at the ABO came up with a predetermined project area is because it creates that economy of scale by having the natural connections of where villages are. We wanted to make sure we were sensitive to the regions as well as the native regions. So, for example, Kangiganak, Kipnuk, Quingilingok, they tend to, and Chivak, right, they are close enough so that they can be a PDPA, and with the combination of the four villages, it gets a lot closer to that 3,000 number to where it's sustainable so that folks can put those numbers in and see.
Very good on the pronunciations.
I've been practicing. I'm a little off still. So. Any follow-up?
Please proceed.
Okay. Similar to the Alaska Broadband Grant Program, we launched the Digital Empowerment Grant Program in mid-December. We anticipate closing that on April 12th. There's no impact to that, no pause necessary from the what the federal government is doing. So that one will proceed. This is simply a visual representation of all the elements of what's going into that. That's all I have for my prepared remarks.
Very informative presentation. Do any members of the Senate Finance Committee have questions at this point? Seeing none, thank you for that. It's a big endeavor, and Alaska is going to be better off once the whole broadband program is constructed and in place. Do you have any closing comments?
No, just thank you to the Senate Finance Committee and thank you, chairs.
Thank you. Let me check my schedule here. That concludes the meeting today. Our next meeting is going to be tomorrow, Wednesday, March 26th at 9 a.m. here in the Senate Finance Room in the State Capitol. We will be hearing from the Alaska Energy Authority.
That's it.
With that, we are adjourned.